From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, ahead of her show in Milwaukee this weekend, comedian Rachel Bloom muses on how her style evolved.
Around the time I started to realize that I could mix my loves of musical theater and comedy writing is around the time that I think I felt like I could finally fully embrace who I was and use my personal experiences and my personality in my comedy.
We'll mark the end of the McDowell Club of Milwaukee after 110 years. And singer-songwriter Marielle Alschwang explains what it was like creating a concept album about the life of artist Mary Knoll.
Bit by bit, finally, we kind of landed on a cluster of things that, as we pulled back from the canvas, actually looked like the person that we knew and loved in our imaginations.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Bonnie North. Rachel Bloom might not be a crazy ex-girlfriend anymore, but the award-winning actress, songwriter, and comedian hasn't stopped performing. From the role of Silver in Angry Birds 2 to her own stage show, Rachel Bloom Live, Bloom is bringing her particular brand of humor and, in the case of the stage show, music to worldwide audiences. Rachel Bloom Live arrives at the Pabst Theater in Milwaukee this Sunday evening. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski was able to catch up with Bloom earlier this week to find out more.
Rachel Bloom, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk today.
It is my pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
So your show and what you're best known for right now is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, and that show is all about how you can get in touch, you know, with your inner happiness and then actually execute it despite many obstacles of life. So now that that chapter of your life is complete, what is your live touring show's central question, or even your central question or mission as you're moving forward personally?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the title of the live show, which is What Am I Going to Do With My Life Now, is basically that. It's. I mean, ultimately what it is the live show is a mix of a lot of stuff from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, some new stuff that I'm working on, and then some stuff I even did pre-Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So it's kind of, because that's the main question I've been getting now ever since the show ended, you know, like 6 months ago, is, okay, so what's next for you? And I'm just kind of like feeling it out, to be honest. There are a lot of choices open for me, and I'm getting almost like a little overwhelmed with the amount of choices. And so the live show is kind of that. It's really just, it's a mix of stand-up and songs, and a lot of the songs are going to be from Crazy Ex.
Well, right. So with this combination of things that you've done throughout your life, you know, you're representing yourself as a comic, but then you're also acting and representing Rebecca Bunch with those songs from Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. How do you want to construct the show that can fittingly and properly juxtapose those two elements while bringing them all together?
Well, it's always me playing myself. And so even when I'm singing songs that got well known for Rebecca singing them, I'm always now kind of playing myself interpreting these songs. So I think that's the commonality in all this, is there's little to no fourth wall. I love interacting with the audience. I love the shows being live. I love the shows changing as they go. And so that's really the only, like, that's the tonal commonality, is me just being in front of the audience acknowledging, hi, I'm Rachel, and I'm performing for you right now, you know?
Right, and some people or actors, you know, have their separate, their character sphere, and some are totally, like you, you know, transparent in representing who they are in a lot of their platforms. And I'm curious, when did you recognize, like, your talent becoming your identity, you know, moving past a passion that you had to being central to your creative content?
Yeah, I mean, I think around the time I started to realize that I could mix my loves of musical theater and comedy writing is around the time that I think I felt like I could finally fully embrace who I was and use my personal experiences and my personality in my comedy. And so I think accepting the kind of musical part of myself and not seeing the worlds of comedy and music as being separate and fighting each other, because oftentimes it's like, well, you got to choose musical theater or sketch comedy, and the answer is you don't, you can combine them, and that's more interesting actually, because you're not doing something where you're trying to do an impression of someone else's voice, you're doing your own voice. And so that kind of synonymous with finding my own voice was me making my personality and point of view a part of my performance. And I think that something that always bothered me about musical theater was the kind of showy guise that you put up, that everything's a show, and God forbid your voice cracks, God forbid you make a mistake, and know that life is messy, and performers are people. And so I think that kind of emphasis on the pristine in musical theater informed how I like to perform music, which is the opposite.
Right, and I imagine there must have been a time where you must have felt disenchanted by that, quote, magic of Broadway and that need to be perfect in your performances all the time.
Yeah, well, because it's boring. I mean, I think that it's a mix of I went to school and I was suddenly faced with people who were more talented than I was. And in musical theater, there is somewhat, especially when you're young and studying it, your self-worth becomes synonymous with your talent, more specifically with, like, your vocal technique and your dance technique. And there is very little room for the nuances and imperfections of, like, how one person interprets something. If Bob Dylan auditioned for musical theater, he wouldn't get a single role. Bob Dylan does not have a technique-perfect musical theater voice. And so I think that first there was a fear, oh, I'm not good enough to be in this musical theater world. My technique isn't necessarily pristine enough. But then there came the realization of, oh, well, why is this such a fear of mine? Why do I feel the need to be perfect all the time? And finding my voice started with me feeling like I wasn't good enough for my goals. And so I said, okay, well, the least I can do is set out to do something individually that only I could do, that kind of made the threat of other people being more perfect lesser in my eyes. So it started out with being a little threatened.
And I think that's a good way to approach things like this. And coming to introduce, you know, and pitch a project like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend that hadn't really been done before, I imagine it turned out to be a strength.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way that we pitched Crazy Ex was it was inspired by these music videos that I had been doing online. That at that point I had embraced putting my own point of view, putting my own vulnerability, putting my own personality into these videos. So by the time Aline Rosh McKenna found me and found my stuff, there was already this inherent tonal point of view to the songs that then made pitching the show not easy, but we had something to point to. It wasn't pitching out of thin air. It wasn't asking the executives to imagine a world in which we had music videos that both were homages to music and musical theater, but also took the piss out of them. We could point to these different genres. And so, yeah, the show was unprecedented, but luckily we had these videos to help back up our pitch.
Right. And along with those videos you created, you also have a range of writing experiences, you know, from short form and Robot Chicken all the way to obviously writing for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. So how has that range influenced how you have approached your projects?
Well, every time you do a new project, you learn something new. And I think that a lot of the things that I learned from jobs, they're not necessarily specific lessons I can point to as much as you learn by osmosis. Just you learn from being around people who are more experienced than you. You learn from being around people who have different skill sets than you do. And it gives me an appreciation for, I mean, in a way, it gives me more options. It makes kind of all the options even more overwhelming, because if I was still just writing sketch comedy and I had an idea, I would always try to fit it within some sort of sketch brain. But now that I also want to be writing narrative TV shows and features, the options are kind of unlimited, which is really cool, but also can be overwhelming. And so I think that, like, more tools for your arsenal allows for more creativity, but also can lead to more choices that leave one paralyzed, like, writing-wise, I think at times.
Yeah. And just so the audience can kind of understand the range of writing songs that you had for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, there's about 157 songs total within that series. And I'm curious, what misconceptions are there about musical theater writing?
God, you know, I think that our show was unique in that we were so relying and going off of established tropes and then doing whatever the opposite was, or doing the trope fully and then the idea contrasting with the trope. But I think in general, the idea that it's easy and that you're going for something frivolous, I think that people automatically hear some stuff in a musical theater style and they think, oh, well, this song is going to be dumb and stupid and frivolous. And sometimes it's frivolity and sometimes it's meant to be escapist. So, you know, people now think about Rodgers and Hammerstein, and a lot of people think about The Sound of Music or Oklahoma as, oh, it's just like happy-go-lucky. But if you actually listen to those lyrics and also understand the context of Rodgers and Hammerstein at the time, it's quite revolutionary. And the lyrics and the music are brilliant. And I think that a lot of people who don't understand musical theater loop most musical theater into kind of this like do-do-do-ba-do-do-ba-do-ba-do-ba-do, you know, walking down the street with my tap shoes on, you know. And that is, some of it is that, but I think the idea that the goal is frivolity is a misconception. And so I think that that's why tonally our show was unique in even when we were taking the piss out of genres, we also had a great appreciation for them. I mean, when I was writing an R&H-inspired song last season, I was listening to a lot of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and they were brilliant.
Yeah, and it's something about listening to a message through, you know, that happy, upbeat, quick-tempoed pace that makes it perhaps a little more digestible. But when you do take the time to examine the lyrics or see what that message is, it can, you know, throw people off sometimes and, you know, make them see that a little differently. And with Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, you know, you have songs about anxiety, depression, all sorts of other serious topics. But what do you think about turning these things into a song is a great way to, you know, not only break it down, but hopefully destigmatize these topics?
Well, God, I mean, from a comedic standpoint, first of all, I think songs, comedy songs, can be some of the most efficient forms of joke delivery that you have, because you're doing a sketch or you're doing a stand-up bit, but you have a structure where you inherently have to state your thesis, which is the chorus or the tagline, and then you support your thesis in the verses. And that's very, very, there isn't room, if you're doing it right, for rambling. All I can say is, as a writer, once I started mixing my love of comedy and musical theater, I felt like I could be vulnerable and open in a way that I couldn't before. And every culture across the world has music. Music is emotional. It's how we express ourselves. It's how we celebrate. It's how we mourn. So there is something inherently primal and universal about music that when you're then dealing with more serious topics or trying to put in more serious topics in a comedy song like we did, the transition is smooth because we're used to listening to music to emotionally relate to something.
Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, over the course of its four seasons, I think could definitely be considered, with its reputation as a cult show. Do you think that anything with the musical format, even if it's modified through a television episode, will always be alienating to audiences in some way?
No, I think that stuff with covers seems to work. I mean, Glee was by far from a cult show. I think the original format is alienating to some people, but then you look at a lot of media aimed for kids, and kids love original songs. So I think that, I don't know.
Do you think, compared to when you first started the pitch and now, that maybe that gap is being filled a little more?
I've heard of a lot of original musical shows being pitched. I have yet to see a lot surface. I think they're maybe getting scripts made or pilots made, but short of things like La La Land, which was technically post Crazy Ex had premiered, even though they've been working on that for years, I don't know. I mean, I was always surprised that the songs on our show didn't go more quote unquote viral. And I couldn't tell you why they didn't. All I can say is that we wrote to the top of our intelligence. I think that the hard part about musical stuff now is you're not only competing with everything on television, but more importantly, you're competing with everything on the internet. And the internet really is the place for musical comedy, because it's these short, you know, 2 to 4 minute videos that you can just watch on YouTube. And mostly the stuff that goes viral musically is stuff that's topical, because there's so much competition now for videos that are watched, for videos that go viral. The stuff that's like incredibly topical and like present in people's minds is going to go viral. So that makes it harder for comedy in general to like spread in a mainstream way. If you're writing a song that feels inherently timeless, there's going to be a topicalness to that song that you can never achieve. So it's, I don't know, these are questions I think about that I don't necessarily have answers to.
Well, and it'll be continue to be a future challenge, right? As you move forward and figure out what's next for you and your projects.
Yeah, I mean, all I can do and all I've ever done was anytime I've tried to write something that I thought would go quote unquote viral or, oh, people are really going to relate to this and love that, love this. It hasn't. 9 times out of 10. You can't predict what other people are going to like and relate to. All you can really do is write what you think is good, what you would want to watch, and what you would think is funny. And that's really all I can continue to do, is write the stuff that I would want to listen to and just hope that other people want to listen to it. And you're dealing with something incredibly subjective, especially in musical comedy. There are so many factors. I mean, I'm incredibly proud of this Hanukkah album, this album of Hanukkah comedy songs that I did, got at this point, 6 years ago with my songwriting partner and my husband. And that is like very few people have heard that album, because it's very specific to like what we think is funny. You kind of have to be Jewish to appreciate it. But all I can do is write stuff that I'd want to see and hear. That's all I can kind of continue to do.
Well, I know what you've done so far has certainly resonated with people. And Rachel Bloom, thanks so much for joining me today for a little while to talk about it.
Thank you so much for having me. This is lovely.
Rachel Bloom speaking with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. Bloom's show in Milwaukee, called Rachel Bloom Live, is this Sunday evening at the Pabst Theater. There is more information at WUWM.com. Coming up after a break, the McDowell Club of Milwaukee is closing its doors after more than a century. We'll talk with longtime member Thallus Drake and current president Carla Coonan after this short break. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. This Sunday, the McDowell Club of Milwaukee will hold its final concert. For more than a century, the club has provided a performance outlet for local musicians and an opportunity for audiences to hear repertoire they might not otherwise have a chance to in a concert setting. But membership has been dwindling over the past years, and it was finally decided to close the doors after the organization's final concert this Sunday at the Villa Terrace Museum. Thallus Drake has been a member of the McDowell Club for decades, and Carla Coonan is the organization's president. They both join me in the studio now. Carla and Thallus, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Indeed.
And it's great to see you, Thallus. It's been a while.
Thank you.
And so we're here to commemorate the end of a very venerable institution here in Milwaukee, and that is the McDowell Club. So Carla, as the president of said club, give us an idea of what this organization has been over the last, 125 years?
It's actually 110 years.
Okay.
We worked really hard to be able to sustain it until the 110th season, which that's what this would be. And what it started out as is a performing group for amateurs and professionals to be able to have a chance to be able to share music with the public free of charge, and also being able to give back to the community by being able to have scholarships available to young musicians. And that has been focus for the last 110 years.
And when you say amateur, you mean it in the best sense of that word,
exactly.
Of people who love what they do.
Exactly. And we have auditions, and that has been, so people have to have some kind of qualification to be able to perform on a public level, but has been an outlet for people to be able to increase their abilities as well. So maybe they started out at a lower amateur level and have been able to continue to play and have reached a higher performance level because of that.
And has the organization encouraged everything from symphonic to chamber music? Is it a whole range of music?
At the beginning, yes. There were, and Thallis might be able to speak better to the history of earlier days. Now it has become more of small ensembles and soloists. However, back in the beginning, there were ensembles that were orchestras. They had a children's orchestra as well as an adult orchestra and bigger ensembles of vocalists also. So, yes.
Oh, not just instrumentalists, of course.
Correct. Sure. Correct. Yes.
Yeah. And so, Thallis, when did you first get involved with the McDowell Club here?
Shortly after I moved to Milwaukee, I needed something to spur me on. I had been studying at the Eastman School of Music, and violin was my major. So this was, well, it was just the wonderfulest thing to have, to be able to continue performing. And this meant practicing. And it just saved my life when I was bearing young children and changing diapers to know that there was something else that I still could do. And I think this is the case for many of our members. We've so enjoyed playing for one another. And in fact, making music is what we're all about, and sharing that music and having the public come in. We would always advertise the concerts and have them in places people could come and enjoy. I think, speaking of ensembles early, we had the very first all-women's orchestra conducted by one of our members and had a woman's chorus. It was just amazing. If you look through our little history book, what this club used to be. We had over 500 members at one time. And then, of course, the wars have come and people's lives have changed. Society, indeed, has changed, and people just don't have the time to devote to this sort of thing anymore, which is unfortunately why we're giving our farewell concert.
Yeah. It is unfortunate because people still love to hear music. People mm-hmm. still love to go to music, and people still love to make music.
Right.
It's unfortunate that something like this can't continue.
Correct.
Yeah, in the way that it is. How was the club funded? Was it donations? Was it membership fees? How had that historically been handled?
A little bit of both. So we always did have a membership fee up until the last, I think, 5 years, when we kind of saw that the end was coming and we were able to have a sustainable amount in our checking account to be able to keep our costs down anyway. But yes, people would make donations to the scholarship funds, to the different programs that we were promoting, and then we always had a membership fee to be able to cover the expenses that we would incur.
So how many people right now for this last concert, how many people are still part of the club?
Well, our membership is down to about 88, I believe, and of those 88, I believe we probably have in the 30s that are active, a real center core of musicians that have really stuck together over the last few years to make the concerts possible and have been really dedicated to making that still possible.
We were determined to make it to 110 years.
And you did.
We made it.
And you did.
Yes.
I forgot to ask Carla, what do you play?
I'm a pianist.
Okay.
Yes.
So the two of you could play together.
We could, yes.
And have?
Well, I've stopped playing a long time ago. One reaches the point in life when you know when to quit.
Well, some people know when to quit.
Exactly.
There are some people who do not quit, and you think, oh, they should. But how do you tell them in a nice way?
Yeah, that is hard.
Yeah. So what kinds of music do you love to play?
I think that I have played so many different things. I've collaborated with so many different instrumentalists and vocalists that I just love to make music. And I love that moment when you connect with a musician, that the music connects you on a different level. It embraces you. It makes the room come alive. It it's almost a spiritual moment because you're creating something that no one else can create but you and whoever it is that you're working with or by yourself. I'm not as much of a soloist as I am a collaborator, and I love that part of it. It's making a connection with someone and then being able to bring that beautiful music then to other people. And so I can't say that I have a favorite because I've had so many great moments.
And Thallis, when you were playing, what did you love to play the most?
Oh, sonatas, I think, for the most part. And I made so many lovely friendships through this club. I remember one time we commissioned Louise Talma, a MacDowell scholar, the MacDowell colony, to compose a piece for the Milwaukee Symphony, the MacDowell Club did. And she came, and we got to be friends, and she sent me a copy of her sonata for violin and piano. And when I performed it with Gertrude Stillman, dear friend, she sent me, both of us, two huge bouquets of roses. You know, things like that are so special to remember.
Yeah, they really are. What are the members going to do once this ends at the weekend?
I think that there are some of those friendships, like Thallis has talked about, that have such a deep root now in music that they'll continue. The concerts may be different. We may not have the same venues that we have had the fortune of being able to use in the past, but I believe that those friendships are going to continue and the music making is going to continue. It's just going to have a different look to it, and it's not going to have the name of MacDowell Club attached to it.
Yeah, and that is sad. It's sad to let that go after more than a century.
Yes, it
is. And that has been such a force for music making here in Milwaukee. What's happening with the scholarships? Is that still continuing? Is that something you can talk about, or do you not have something in place yet?
No, we do have it in place. We are working with the Milwaukee Foundation to be able, Greater Milwaukee Foundation, to be able to have our scholarship money that we have saved to be able to continue our legacy for the future. So we had the goal of having $50,000. We're really, really close. We're under $2,000 that we have almost gotten every penny we need to be able to leave $50,000. And we have three organizations that we are going to be giving then those monies to over the years. And they, once we completely finalize all of that, that will become public if it hasn't already snuck out. But yes, there are three local music organizations that will be getting the monies for that every
year.
Very
cool. And that, it's almost like an endowment.
Exactly.
That takes the name on into
Correct.
The future, even though the organization itself has
right.
stopped.
MacDowell Club of Milwaukee Fund.
Very nice. And that's nice that's because one of the things, and Thallis, you and I have talked about this over the years when we've talked about early music and we've talked about other things. One of the stumbling blocks for a lot of kids is they can't afford an instrument.
Oh, absolutely.
And they can't afford a lesson
mm-hmm.
or a series of lessons or lessons with people who are really going to advance them. And, you know, so to have that kind of money available is
right.
just so crucial.
And we really tried to make sure that the three different organizations that will receive the money will be organizations that are going to help young kids, that will be able to help the middle age grades, and to be able to advance for the college students as well. So we really did try. The board spent many months really narrowing down how can we best leave a legacy to the Milwaukee area for the future musicians and making it a good choice for that.
Very cool. So tell me about the final concert. What are we going to hear?
Oh, it's a big list. I wish I'd brought it with me, but we have about 13 or 14 of our members performing, which is lovely. It's a broad spectrum of composers, flute and guitar, little vocal ensemble, some solo pianists. I think people are just going to really enjoy this because it's such a diverse kind of, which is what we've always been about. Our programs have not been one person or two. We usually open it to our members who wish to perform something they've been working on. And so it's become sort of our trademark that you're going to hear a lot of different things.
Right, and it's a celebration
of
something.
Absolutely.
It's not just a farewell, it's a celebration.
Correct.
We did a huge celebration for our 100th. We had several concerts, each with a commission, several of MacDowell compositions were performed at each one. It was indeed a celebration, but this time it's sort of nostalgic.
A celebration, but also a little bit of melancholy.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yes. So the concert is on Saturday, September 22nd at the Villa Terrace Museum, and it will begin at 5 o'clock. And we have and one short intermission. There's going to be a cash bar available at that time, too. And again, a time to be able to celebrate the 110 years. Hopefully a little fundraising will happen to be able to bring us up to the end of that $50,000 that we're trying to raise, but really a chance to be able to celebrate friendships and music making for 110 years here in Milwaukee.
Well, even if the organization is ending, the mission of the organization, the heart of the organization isn't.
Right.
It sounds like. It sounds like that's going to continue.
Music making will continue in Milwaukee, that's for sure.
Excellent. Well, Thallus and Carla, it has been such a pleasure. I'm sorry it was under these circumstances that I had to talk to Thallus again and meet you for the first time, but I'm really glad you came in to tell us about this.
Thank you, Bonnie.
You were so gracious to let us do this. Thank you so much.
Carla Coonan is the president of the McDowell Club of Milwaukee. Thallus Drake is the organization's recording secretary. The club will present a final free concert this Sunday at the Villa Terrace Museum on Milwaukee's East Side before they'll disband after 110 years of music making. There's more information about the club and the final concert at WUWM.com. We'll take one final break, and then Milwaukee singer-songwriter Marielle Alschwang performs some music from her newest album, which is based on the life and art of Mary Knoll. We'll hear more when Lake Effect returns right after this on Milwaukee's NPR. With more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. It's been dubbed the Witch's House. Urban legends portray the former owner and creator as a loner, shut up in her home, creating the concrete statues that adorn the yard. But artist Mary Knoll was no witch. She was a prolific artist, an innovator, and a caring friend. And that's what attracted Marielle Alschwang to her work. The singer-songwriter found herself enamored by the folklore surrounding Knoll's life and the artwork she created, and it inspired her new album, Procession of a Day, The World of Mary Knoll. Alschwang describes the album as a portrait of Knoll through the eyes of her group, Marielle Alschwang and the Visitations. Alschwang joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio, along with bandmate Adam Krause. This is their song, Built to Bloom, Procession Aria.
Built to Bloom and Procession Aria from Marielle Alschwang. She's joining us now in studio along with guitarist Adam Krause. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
So your new album, it's called Procession of a Day, The World of Mary Knoll. So we have to start here. Who is Mary Knoll?
She is an artist who lived from 1914 to 2001, who actually grew up in Milwaukee, and for most of her life had a home right off the shore of Lake Michigan. It's actually still there in Fox Point, Wisconsin. And created an artist-built environment at that home. So it's just sprawling with artworks inside and outside, made of all kinds of different materials that she found or salvaged and saved and transformed all through various media that you can think of, from painting to ceramics to wire mesh figures to woodworking to cement sculptures, where she mixed the cement herself from the sand right off of the lake. So prolific is an understatement. And we also may know her through the Mary L. Knoll Fund that the Greater Milwaukee Foundation grants to artists here in Milwaukee. So she's pretty legendary on a couple different levels, many levels.
What did you find so inspiring about, you know, not just her work, but also her life?
I identify as an artist myself, and she said once that her art identifies her. And there's all kinds of intersectionalities and hybridities that we bring along with us, but the fact that she had this really visible autonomy and was so devoted to her work and exercised her will upon the world in this really, what I find, you know, now in the modern sort of global context, to be a sustainable and, you know, pro-environmental ecological way, is heroic and really inspiring.
When you say exercised her will upon the world, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so as an artist, it seemed like she was an innovator since, you know, her early childhood. There are drawings she had of a piano box that she turned into like a playhouse for her and her friends in the neighborhood. One of our songs is about this airplane contest where she was the only girl out of like 27 people to make it to the finals or something. And she created cement in her bathtub as a kid. She adapted her shoes to be like rain boots or to be able to work in sort of more muddy environments while working. And she owned a ceramics shop. She went to Chicago and like picked out a kiln and so many things as an artist, in addition to these journals she kept, where she kept in touch with friends, and she was a very present person and sort of was aware and made note of even the most minute things in her environment. And also I found through these journals that she, you know, would write representatives about like, you know, you should try to keep the shoreline cleaner or things like that. Not to like get into the politics of Mary Knoll, but I think her engagement with politics or with the body politic and her work, it all combines for me in this way that is someone who was very seen as an eccentric to many, but was very centered and was able to exercise her will in her own way from her own sort of central point.
For people who haven't seen her work specifically, how would you describe it?
That's a really good question, because I think it has some similarities to other. It's definitely unique to her. She had her own sort of lexicon, visual lexicon that included what she called spooks and giant fish and dinosaurs and all these sort of whimsical, visionary things. Also, a really uncanny character that crops up in groups, almost like a mushroom patch or something. These figures with bowler hats, still don't know exactly what that is. And just sort of floating figures in boats. I think she was also really influenced by seeing the lake every day. But, you know, as an aesthetic, I do see similarities between her work and other Wisconsin-based artists. There's this sort of Midwestern visionary aesthetic that I don't exactly think is, you know, everybody getting together and like, let's draw this way, you know, let's all have hybrid humanoid creatures or something. But I don't know, maybe there's just something about this place that inspires a certain look to the work.
The folklore, the shared community.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. And there's a lot that I had discovered about Mary Knoll as sort of a more social person. Like, you know, she did have parties with other artists there. One of whom I weirdly recognized in a picture as being an artist that was like friends with my grandparents or something. And then I could see like, oh yeah, like this profile, this, you know, just the line from this drawing by this artist kind of resembles this one that she created. So, yeah, we do share a lot of information, maybe tacitly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell me about this next song, Newsletter. How does it relate to Mary Knoll and her life?
Yeah, so this one is about, or actually directly taken from the mimeographed letters that I told you about. The John Michael Kohler Art Center has tons of them, and we were only able to look at a few, but I just picked out one and kind of pulled a William Burroughs on it. So it's a cut-up of one newsletter. Yeah, all of the words are hers.
Newsletter by Marielle Alschwang. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, when I thought about this album and when I started listening to you, I had to wonder, what was it like writing songs for this? Because in some ways, having a concept and having a theme, they can feel both limiting and freeing.
Yes. We're huge subscribers of that philosophy. I see Adam. Yeah.
We do like limitations. They help, but they can be very confusing too. We did a lot of the reading and research together, and then I remember we had a giant sheet of paper, and we wrote Mary Knoll in the center with a circle, and then made a giant Venn diagram with the themes working out from her name, and then sort of started picking like how we want to handle the narrative of this one person's life and what are the things that are important to us. Because there's, I mean, the Kohler was telling us they have something like 6,000 pieces by her in their collection. Like, she's prolific beyond belief. She lived a very long time. She traveled everywhere. Like, there's so much you could say about her that, you know, picking sort of a thread and making a narrative and picking out themes of our own around that narrative was kind of the first challenge. And then once we did that, we said, you know, there were a couple songs that had already that were just sort of wrote themselves, and then we needed some more. And so we sort of picked like, well, we need to talk about this because we'd like to, and we'd like to talk about this. And then sometimes writing about a theme can be easy, and sometimes it can be very difficult.
Yeah, it was sort of like a 5-year-long process of painting someone's portrait. Recently, in the past month, I kept thinking about like Gertrude Stein, or like her portraits of objects and people, and how fractured or fractal it can be. And as Adam said, very much us being aware that it's from our perspective, it's the things about her that we find important. And I think that was very grounding, because it can be overwhelming to think about Mary Knoll as a figure who's impacted so many people, and everybody has their own memories, whether it be, you know, being a teenager and like driving past her house, or I just met someone who is a student, an art student of hers, because she taught public school for a little while, and obviously people who had met her and spoken with her and written about her and are stewards of her work still. So yeah, if we were researching not just Mary Knoll's life, but also delving into the themes that were orbiting around this central subject. And every time something seemed like a really urgent thing to say about her, then that's where like a song would come and we would start trying to flesh it out. So bit by bit, finally, we kind of landed on a cluster of things that, as we pulled back from the canvas, actually looked like the person that we knew and loved in our imaginations.
What were the things that you really wanted to include in this? When you did take a step back, what were the things that you said, this has to be a part of this? This is such a part of her.
Yeah. Well, the first thing I wanted to get across was the collaborative aspect of Mary Knoll, to sort of demystify this idea of her as the witch, this like reclusive figure, and sort of bring a lot of love into it. I just wanted to dump as much love into this bucket that we were churning our songs into as much as possible, and friendship and also collaboration with her natural environment. That was something that struck me immediately when I went to her home and was sort of exploring her work initially years ago. You know, the driftwood and the sand and the lake and the sounds and the light coming through and all of these sort of stained glass mobiles and things that she made, in addition to, you know, this, as somebody who creates art or music, you know, a collaboration with sort of these really ineffable, ephemeral things, you know, your memories, you know, her thinking about how her brother might have influenced her, how her parents, how her experiences, her travels, all of these things that to a huge extent she cataloged and recorded and made drawings of and all that. But what is this sort of like essence, and how can exploring Mary Knoll be a vehicle of that process, I guess, as a creative person? That was a really long answer to the first one. But also, you know, while I'm on the subject of the artistic process, there's a song that was the last one that we had written, and it's the last one in our song cycle, called Turning, and it's about why we chose Procession as the title, this sort of ongoing cyclic force around a central axis. But in that song, it's sort of more of a metaphor, I guess, for kind of reaching this point, this back and forth or this ongoing cycle of, is this any good? Why am I doing this? Why does it look different now than it did yesterday? What's compelling me to make these adjustments? Or when will I finally, you know, accept it as being finished? Like Mary Knoll never signed a painting because she was never finished with anything, you know? And I think a lot of us can relate to that. And ironically, the song that addressed that ended up being sort of our, well, I guess we're done now in the process of writing this project. But I think that is also definitely something that we wanted to get across, in addition to many other more biographical anecdotes and themes.
Would you like to play that for us?
Oh, sure.
Turning.
Yeah. Before you start, I would just like to say, Marielle, Adam, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you about it.
Local singer-songwriter Marielle Alschwang playing her song Turning from her latest album Procession of a Day, The World of Mary Knoll. She was joined by guitarist Adam Krause, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Jason Reavy engineered our in-studio performance. Marielle Alschwang and the Visitations will be performing at the Oriental Theater this Saturday, September 21st at 7. You can find more information at wuwm.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. Joy Powers and Audrey Nowakowski join me in producing Lake Effect every week with help from Trapper Shep and Maggie Holford. We also get support from the WUWM news team, including Emily Files and Taryn Powell this week. Lauren Sigfusson is our digital producer, Jason Reavy our studio engineer, and Michelle Maternowski is our managing editor. Willie Porter wrote our theme music. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
To a space which might be infinite, and to a constant turning, 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 when souls leave their pilgrim homes, will they find this one? Does my work here leave a trace, invisible to and unbound by the living? Have to dive to rise and see outside of time and inside the secret that sends us turning.